sorry that I can't take you. In the morning, going to Chicago, and I'm sorry that I can't take you. Ain't nothing in Chicago for a sweet little boy like you to do. 'Cause when I get there, I'm gonna drink mash, I'm gonna talk trash, gonna spend my money in the morning. Drink mash, talk trash, I'm gonna spend my money in the morning. Gonna have me one hell of a time till I see me a rooster sitting right in the middle of Ross Street crowing for the dawning.
That's Ernestine Anderson and Red Holloway on tenor sax, opening up with Going to Chicago, the title track of Ernestine Anderson's 1984 album, When the Sun Goes Down. Also appearing, Gene Harris on piano, Ray Brown on bass, and Garrick King on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, April the 8th, the day after the great Chicago runoff. And, of course, we know that the outcome is that Rahm Emanuel returns to City Hall for a second term. Chicagoans are taking it in stride, and political gurus are mining the numbers for hidden clues about the race. Emanuel's win with 56% of the vote came the hard way, and with a repeat of the message that he's not nearly the gift he thinks he is to Chicago. Challenger and first-time mayoral contender Jesus Chuy Garcia, a Cook County commissioner who helped block Emanuel from winning a majority of the votes in the February 24th election, which forced a runoff, got 44% of the vote. And Gardas Henry Watts, our listener correspondent who told us 2 days ago about how things were shaping up, joins us once again to tell us how his hometown is dealing with the outcome. Henry, Rahm Emanuel is back in City Hall for 4 more years. How's that going down in Chi-Town today?
It's mixed reaction with the Rahm Emanuel victory. It's an interesting victory for Rahm, because apparently last night he seemed to kind of humble himself a little bit more, which is, you know, a dog and pony show to let his constituents know he'll be much nicer in this next round of serving as mayor. But the interesting part is, I think Monday when I said participation, excitement didn't seem like it was there. Looking at the numbers, the participation wasn't that much better. Last month's election relatively had 33% voter participation. Yesterday's election only garnered about 40%. So it was just slightly up a little. The African-American community didn't fare well as far as participation as well. Rahm took most of the majority black wards here in the city, but within those wards, relatively, there was an average of about 35% participation in those particular wards, which Rahm basically won. I think the thing is, and I've touched on this on Monday, is the outreach from Garcia to the African-Americans here in Chicago. They just didn't trust him enough to vote for him. And as I said before, Rahm, they were looking for a reason to vote Rahm out. However, because Garcia didn't outreach enough to the African-American community, and it is not all his fault because of the fact that he came in a little late, stepped in for Karen Lewis, who was the Chicago Teacher Union president, who was looking to run. And having 6 weeks from the general election on February 24th up until now is really not enough time to get your face out there and do some, you know, groundwork to try to get the community rallying behind you. I mean, stuff like that takes years and probably a whole mayoral election term to get that type of support. So Chewy coming in late was probably his downfall of why he didn't win, because Chicagoans really were looking for a good reason not to vote for Rahm. But as you've seen, the numbers, the participation level wasn't really that high.
In the immediate aftermath, you know, with the victory celebration and so forth, you mentioned that Rahm Emanuel made a strong effort to communicate that he was going to be a kinder, gentler mayor. Did that come across as sincere?
Well, whatever Rahm says, you basically have to take it with a grain of salt. The only thing we can do is just see if he is sincere by acting on it. I know in one of the debates, there was some talk about him talking about the O'Hare. There was an issue in one of the wards where O'Hare Airport is. A lot of residents were generally very upset about the new runway that they built there, and it was causing a lot of noise pollution. And Chewy took him to task about trying to resolve that issue. However, Rahm basically never confronted the constituents in that ward to talk about those type of issues. So he did promise that he was going to go out into the neighborhoods a little more. And like I said, you just basically take it with a grain of salt. Looking at his past history, I don't think that he's going to do it, but, you know, we'll see.
Where did his vote come from? Where did his votes, I should say, come from?
Majority of his votes, like I said, were from the white community, basically, got his votes. Majority of Northside well-off-to-do constituents got his vote. And like I said, the very few African Americans who voted also voted for him as well. It's interesting in regards to the mayoral race compared to, like, the aldermanic races that happened within the city, because a lot of rubber-stamp aldermen who were in runoffs yesterday did not get a seat in their aldermanic elections, which was kind of shocking, because some of these wards that basically were rubber-stamped Rahm Emanuel council people lost their elections. One in particular was in the 7th Ward, where Gregory Mitchell defeated Natasha Holmes. Now, Natasha Holmes basically was an appointed alderman after Sandy Jackson, who is the wife of Jesse Jackson Jr. They both went to jail for campaign fraud. And she was the appointed person from Rahm Emanuel, who Natasha Holmes, to sit on the aldermanic seat until the next election. And it's interesting because she was actually backed by Chicago Forward, the PAC who supports Rahm Emanuel with, you know, millions of dollars in their campaign coffers. And it was a surprising upset for her not to win, since Gregory Mitchell is really not part of the machine like Natasha is, because he garnered about 57% of the vote in that particular ward. And a couple of other automatic elections in regards to John Arena, who is supported by the Chicago Teachers Union, and another interesting one in the 10th Ward, which is the aldermanic race between Susan Garza and John Pope. And that is a very, very interesting race, which is actually still to this moment is still undecided, because the votes were very close. Last I looked, that race was only separated by 50 votes, actually, with Susan Garza being in the lead. And I'm going to tell you why that's very important, because it's an environmental issue going on in that ward. Harvey from California will probably love this one. But in the 10th Ward, which is on the southeast side of Chicago, there's a steel mill, and then there's an agrifying plant. It's an animal feed producer. And there's so many environmental violations going on there. It's actually ridiculous. Well, the incumbent alderman of Hope is the alderman, and he has done nothing to clean up that area. So Susan Garza is basically the one who's going to try to come in and, you know, basically try to clean up the environment there, because when you ride past that area, you can actually smell some of the stuff that's coming out of those refineries and the steel mills. And Pope is basically is a rubber stamp councilman for Rahm Emanuel as well. So how do you read this, Henry, that you
mentioned that many of the so-called rubber stampers of Rahm Emanuel's policies did not themselves prevail in the election? How do you read that?
Well, I think the thing is, people are taking more precedence to what's going on in their area compared to what's going on in City Hall. I think people are putting more importance on who is their alderman, because as alderman, you know, you still have to, in regards to businesses still have to go through the alderman to get certain things passed or ordinances passed within particular wards. So Chicagoans are, I guess, sort of waking up politically because of the fact that some of these ward aldermen are just basically rubber stamping everything Rahm does, and they're basically tired of it. So in a sense that they are waking up, I will say that that is the one bright spot of the election yesterday. A lot of rubber stamp aldermen got voted out, which was somewhat of half a victory for Chicago, or working Chicago.
Well, what is being said in the Jesus Garcia camp, the Karen Lewis camp, how are they reacting today?
Well, I guess the thing is, I was watching Chewy's speech when he conceded the election yesterday, probably like about 20 minutes after they declared Rahm the victor. He basically just kind of gave the standard speech of, you know, still moving Chicago forward, grassroots organizations. I really haven't seen a lot of anything exciting or new or something to look forward to in regards to the Chewy Garcia camp. So nothing really but the standard thank you, Chicago, for helping me get to this particular place.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I just want to end this on a personal note. You personally, as a Chicagoan, how did this race affect you?
Well, I do a lot of work in Chicago. It affects me in a way. However, I'm not really that much affected since my family lives in the suburbs. But I have a lot of dealings in Chicago in regards to the work I do. So this affects me somewhat. But like the Chicago people, I think it's more aldermanic effect than anything. Is what the Chicago voters basically said yesterday. So even though it does affect me a little bit, whatever particular area that I'm working in, it'll affect me a little more than anything. But actually, too, this race also affects a lot of the outlying suburbs as well, because, you know, Chicago is a big city, and a lot of people, even in the suburbs, was looking at this race as well with bated breath.
Well, thank you. There's nothing worse than bated breath. I'm told it smells real bad. Thank you so much for your contribution. And I'm so delighted that as we have a listener correspondent, that is to say, we are drawing on the natural talents of our pool here of listeners on Lead Stories. Thank you so much for contributing this primer, first of all, on Monday, and today the follow-up as to what happened yesterday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. When we take this break, when we come back, why Rahm Emanuel should have been defeated?
While you were sleeping, I called up my good time and friends in Chicago. Yes, I did. I took some change from your pocket and I called up my good time and friends in Chicago. They said, we got room for you. Come on to Chicago. Do us a favor and leave your funny time man at home. Hey, we gonna party hardy. We're waiting on ya. Come on to Chicago. So I'm going to Chicago. Sorry that I can't take you. You see, there ain't nothing in Chicago for a sweet little boy like you do.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm your Trace Lead. And why Rahm Emanuel should have been defeated? We will tell you up front, and we'll get to that in the course of our discussion. There are at least 31 very, very important reasons why Rahm Emanuel should have been defeated. But let's start. The first thing that we need to take note of is that Chicago has a major, major role here in its history in answering this very question, because it was in Chicago that a lot of political development took place, and not only within the confines of the city, but also outside of the city, impacting the entire nation. Technically, Jesus Chuy García technically should have been a Rainbow Coalition candidate. He should have been. But of course he couldn't, because it does not exist as an independent entity. And when I said 31 reasons, I'm referring to the number of years that Jesse Jackson had as a presidential candidate, given license, given permission back in 1984 to construct an alternative political system, and did not. He was given another opportunity in 1988, again, with permission from a broad spectrum of constituencies who came together, hurdled over all these historic barriers to dealing with each other, but seeing the logic and the strategy of consolidating their political power as leverage against a Democratic Party. This man himself, Jesse Jackson, in 1984, complained and spoke outright about the fact that the Democratic Party was a party of exclusion, and basically recalling the same spirit of Fannie Lou Hamer of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, served notice that he was going to spearhead a move away from the Democratic Party to strike out and create something different, because the statistics said it. You know, Jesse Jackson, there's such a parallel here. Jesse Jackson in 1984, everybody was laughing at him. A lot of people laughed at him. Running for president? Sure. Okay. Yeah, sure, that's going to work. But you know, Jesse Jackson did phenomenally well in 1984. And of course, by the time he decided to run in 1984, it was because Shirley Chisholm ran in 1972 and laid that groundwork for somebody. She had a long coattail. She dragged somebody along many years later. From 72 to 1984, Jackson emerges as the second African-American to run for the national office. Now, by this time, of course, he was the beneficiary of Shirley Chisholm blazing a trail, but let's be clear, Shirley Chisholm was impeded by whom? The black folks, many of them who were just absolutely slavishly devoted to the Democratic Party and did everything possible to impede her success. But nevertheless, she, like Jackson, was under no illusion that she was going to win, because she had already redefined winning. Winning was blazing the trail, clearing a path for somebody years later who would not have to deal with the brunt of such an assignment, that they would have an easier time of it, and Jesse had an easier time of it. This man got several million votes. He got, in the primary, 3.2 million votes. He got 18.2% of the total. And that is spectacular by any measure, just like Chewy. Now, they say Chewy came to the race late, Chewy this, Chewy that. But guess what? It was what it was. If anybody had said to Jesse Jackson, look, you don't have money, you don't have troops, you don't have this, you don't have that, why not just delay this thing and wait another time? He felt the time was right, and basically, whether people agreed with it or not, the fact is, if you are in a fight, you don't make appointments to see, we prefer if this fight should happen at 2 o'clock this afternoon as opposed to tomorrow morning. It's on. When the fight is on, you got to jump in. You cannot be neutral when the stakes are high. So when Jesse Jackson declared his race in 1984 and the people responded, it wasn't a matter, they could have said, well, you're not ready. Well, you don't have this, you don't have that. The fact is, he was in it. And you couldn't be neutral, not if you're an activist. You had to make a decision. You're either with him or you're not. No middle ground. He did so well, remarkably well, in 1984, that by the time he decided to repeat it in 1988, people said yes. Again, they said yes again. We will shore up your strategy. We will come together and push you as far as we can, because the first time was a great success. And again, success didn't mean that he won and was in the White House. Success meant he proved a point. Won. He proved that people were disgusted with the Democratic Party and the political duopoly as a whole. Two, he proved that there were enough people willing to just discard all those impediments to progress and to come together to leverage the power that they did have, because he had the votes to prove it. And three, he proved that there was a rational response, that he was tapping into this frustration and this desire to move outside of the duopoly, and specifically to move outside of the Democratic Party. But what did we see? Between 1984 and 1988, Jesse Jackson put every single hard-won vote up on the auction block to the Democratic Party and transformed a popular movement into personal gain. He killed off the possibility of a third way just at the moment it had such great promise. And he did it deliberately. He sold his soul and his supporters right down the tube to the Democrats. Now, let's fast forward. Here in Chicago, the mere fact that Rahm Emanuel couldn't, in the first round, garner more than enough votes to outright resist a runoff successfully tells you he ain't all that. He was vulnerable, disliked, distrusted, and he represented a party that people had come to hate. When an incumbent mayor, with the benefit of millions of dollars in your coffers, with the benefit of wealthy backers, with the benefit of white Chicago, white wealthy Chicago, you know, Chicago being a bastion of racism, of apartheid, when those folks side with you and they've got the money and the power, and you have all that going with you, you have name recognition, you have the advantage of incumbency 4 years, and with all of that, you could not fend off a challenge. You barely could scrabble up together a majority vote. That tells you something. And here again, in the second time around, with even more money, with even more white support, white supremacist support, with even more aggressive a campaign, bashing the heck out of Chuy Garcia, you just got 56% of the vote, just about 5 percentage points more than you did the first time. That tells you something. You're not all that. You're not the greatest gift. It tells us that this Democratic mayor, who is a stone-cold Clintonite, who is lethal to the interests of working and poor people in the city of Chicago, could have been defeated and should have been defeated. But he prevailed. And why? I'll advance a couple of theories. Number one, Karen Lewis. Now, here's what is fantastic about Karen Lewis. Here's a woman who had been encouraged to run, who seriously was thinking of running, and as we discussed you on this program, aborted her effort because she had a major health challenge. She was diagnosed with a brain tumor. But what did she do? She acted like an inspired and inspiring leader. She went to Chuy Garcia. Now, that is significant. And it is also a hint as to why there was this lackluster support for Chuy Garcia on the part of the so-called African-American leadership to begin with. You see, Karen Lewis did something that Jesse Jackson had not done in 31 years, and that was she built her constituency. She went into that Chicago Teachers Union, which was in a state of disarray. She brought it together as a what? Coalition. And in coalition within the union, that is extraordinary leadership that she exercised there. The union then realized its full strength and power. And with that, she confronted Rahm Emanuel face to face, toe to toe, and she kicked his butt. Now, that's formidable leadership. And I will, from here, I can tell you that that very thing was so resented, I'm sure, by the established black male-dominated leadership, people like Jackson and others, who said, well, who the heck are you? We are the kingmakers around here. But she went to Chewy. She didn't ask anybody permission because she had all that she needed in order to. She had the authority. She had the money with the union. She had the organization of membership. And she had a strong determination and will to fight this man, to kick him out of office. And she did the most inspiring thing, which is to say, she chose Chewy, not the black leadership that was there, that didn't do so well in the first round. She said, let me go for somebody outside of this. And what did she do? She committed fully to his success. I'm bringing you not only my personal endorsement, I'm bringing you troops, I'm bringing you money, I'm bringing you an organization, and I'm bringing you predictable votes. So she's speaking as a leader, not these jive turkeys running around in Chicago. Coming to Chewy Garcia many, many, many days late and many, many, many dollars short. Look, we all know the language of politics. Standing up in front of a camera, standing in front of a mic and flapping your lips about endorsing this candidate, well, yeah, we with him. With that level of enthusiasm, you know it's purely symbolic. They weren't feeling that. They weren't feeling that at all. They resented, and I know I'm going to get a lot of reaction here, but it was a racist element in the black leadership. Who the hell is this guy? We are not ready to yield our power, all of it, by the way, just perceived, all of it symbolic, not real. But who the heck is this guy to come and supplant us? This is our turf. Who the heck is he? This Mexican. We ain't all that. We're not too enthused about this. And Karen Lewis lost her way. She should have come to the black community and gotten a black man, and that's how it ought to have worked. But in fact, they were not ready. And when they did come forward with endorsements, those endorsements were, in my view, largely symbolic. What do I mean? Here's how you talk business when you mean to talk politics. And you mean to be sincere. You walk in the door, you sit at the table, and you say, listen, here's what I'm prepared to do for you. We don't have a lot of money, but here's a check for $50,000 just the same. I'm going to commit myself to raising even more. I don't have it, but I'm committed to raising as much money as I can to support your candidacy. Number two, I got troops. I'm pledging you today that I will deliver 400 volunteers to you. They'll hit the streets and we'll do an aggressive campaign. And number three, you know, I've got a serious vested interest in your success. So I've got some money, I've got an organization, and I've got some name recognition, which I will put at your disposal in order to get you over the hump, because we have a vested interest in your success. Now, that's how you talk when you are a serious leader. But the fact is, none of these people running their lips in front of these cameras have no organization. They cannot walk into a room and say, I will deliver to you 10,000 votes or 40,000 votes. They don't have that capacity to do. And 31 years for Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, and Jackson to this day doesn't have a party established in every one of those states where he won, both in 1984 or 1988. His coattails have not carried anybody to victory. And his organization cannot commit even to this day, to say, well, look, we know we can deliver 40,000 votes, 20,000 votes, to quantify it with certainty. So they walk in with two long hands, and they think that's enough. And that is why I say the spectacular leadership here of Karen Lewis is not to be dismissed. And I don't have to ask, but I know that her action just rattled these so-called establishment blacks who are so into the Democratic Party, it's ridiculous. So Rahm Emanuel was not at all insurmountable as an opponent, very much from the very beginning. He wasn't all that great. He was particularly vulnerable in Chicago. But if we had a vehicle established, it would have worked. Now, people say, well, he came late to the race. So what? So what he came late to the race? They're now devolving blame. Well, he shouldn't have come so late. Listen, this is politics. He's in the race. Your choice as a leader is to either get with it or shut up and go away. Don't tell people, well, he's late in the race. So what? Jackson was late twice for president. Okay? The point I'm making here is we are seeing in 2015 the consequence of failed leadership going all the way back to 1984 and in Chicago, where this should not have happened because we saw it work with Harold Washington, who won and maintained his power in Chicago on the basis of coalition politics. That's the truth of it. And who set an example for others to follow? Coalition politics is important. There is this illusion among some in the so-called leadership that, oh, it could be an all-black thing. Well, you be an all-black thing and fail every time. The statistics are telling you, at some point, you work in coalition with others to achieve a shared objective. You got to watch it. You got to be on point because, you know, it's politics and people will steal your coffee, steal your milk right out of your coffee, steal your teeth right out of your mouth. Coalition means that you come together. It's not a permanent marriage. It is about people putting their shared interests together to leverage the political power inherent in that in order to achieve a major objective. The major objective here was so clear. Get this guy out. Get him out. And the leadership, the African-American and Latino leadership, particularly these two groups, it was to be their job to see to it that the constituencies that they supposedly have such clout with fall in line and see the wisdom of putting that objective into play and winning at it. But they hobbled. They hobbled by their own design. They're acolytes of the Democratic Party. They're creatures of it, of the machine. And some of them cannot afford to create any kind of distance between them and it. So wrapped up are their personal and political fortunes with the Democratic Party. Just the same, let's be real clear about something. Chuy Garcia's campaigns both in the February 24th election and 6 weeks later, just 6 weeks. All these people should have been descending on Chicago from all over the country. We had a couple of them coming in to help Chewy. But in fact, I thought they would have been on top of this from the minute Karen Lewis signaled, look, we have this guy here, let's get behind him. And the organizational effort would begin immediately because he's working against a formidable set of obstacles. Time being number one, he didn't have that much money. But none of these things, I maintain, none of these things would have been serious impediments if the leadership was clear about what it is that it had to do. But you see, they played games. And a specifically, just a quintessential moment in time was lost because of them. It ain't Chewy. It's them. It's them. So this is not to be seen at all in the context of whether Chewy made a good candidate or whether he had his act together. Or none of this, as I say, it pales in comparison to the number one issue here, and that is, for whatever reason, the black leadership was not prepared, and the Latino leadership was only too late to coalesce. They were not prepared. And the white leadership, they did step forward, but again, not in time, and they dilly-dallied a little bit, as if they were waiting for some kind of green light to miraculously give them permission to move. But when I talk about inspired and inspiring leadership, and I go back to that that has been exhibited by Karen Lewis here, she ain't waiting for any signals. You don't have to wait for signals. You see what the situation is, and you make a decision, because that's what makes you a, quote, leader, unquote. In the midst of all the craziness and confusion and complexities, you are able to see the benefit of moving fast, moving decisively, and moving strategically. This day should have been a day for Chicago to rejoice and the rest of the country to rejoice, because it isn't just about Rahm Emanuel as a person. Let's be clear. He is what he is as a person. Everybody's got to be something. But we're looking at the kind of politics that he represents, the lethal effect it has had, this Clintonite supposed third way that has unfortunately also infected the Obama administration. People have to fight it. And here was a great moment to fight. This was a fantastic moment to fight. Serve notice on the Democratic Party that you are increasingly irrelevant to our needs and visions. Not only that, we consider the party lethal to our interests, and we must find another way. But again, I don't want anybody to forget or to miss the dimension of history here and why Chicago should have been the appropriate place to begin the resurgence of this this coalition effort, because the prominent Chicagoan, Jesse Jackson, blew it in 1984. He blew it in 1988, and he blew it ever since, and yet runs around with portfolios acting like he's a leader. But he, because of Jesse Jackson's run in 1984 and in 1988, Chicago today, this day, should have had its first Rainbow Coalition mayor. Its first Rainbow Party. I mean, this would have been a joy. Now, this doesn't mean the fight is over. Let's be real clear here. Chuy Garcia did phenomenally well. I know people have said, well, he didn't win. He won. If you understand that winning itself has to be redefined. He proved it. The numbers are there. The Democratic Party is, you know, people are disgusted with it. We're hearing about 33% participation rate. We're hearing about the racial bifurcation. Wealthy whites go with Rahm, and the poor and whatnot, they're just not interested. And people could understand that. There's nothing to vote for. And that is exactly what they wish. That is exactly what the party wishes. And in this regard, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are the same. Never mind all this talk about voting. What they want is a predictable vote that is totally manageable. The thing that would scare the heck out of any of them, either Republican or Democrat, is that people should vote like crazy. Oh, no, 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 that's going to really upset things. Why? Because races are decided at every level on the basis of predictability of the vote. If in a congressional district, for example, you can win with 5,000 votes, the last thing they want is 8,000 people voting, because those extra 3,000 pose a problem. They will now have to be, find out who these people are. How are they likely to vote? What their concerns are? When, if you know you need just 5, and you make it your point to understand the habits and attitudes of those 5, as long as you have your 5, you're good. So they conduct this elaborate scheme to make people think that they want very, very energetic voting. No, they don't. They want a predictable vote. And here again, Rahm Emanuel prevailed because he produced a predictable vote. He got his predictable support from whites, wealthy whites in Chicago. That was predictable. That's not accidental. He got his predictable share of the black vote from people who just have no brains and can't think for themselves and are up to their eyeballs in the Democratic Party's machine, the largesse that it dispenses, albeit grudgingly, to compliant blacks. So they got their predictable votes. With Jesse Jackson, I'm going to postulate this theory now. With Jesse Jackson, let's pray for this miracle, okay? I'm speaking hypothetically, of course, which is it's going to be obvious. Let us say that Jesse Jackson had experienced an epiphany as a leader. He would have used himself very differently in this race. He would have revived that spirit that he had in 1984, when he outlined a whole bunch of things that he was going to include in his party platform, you know, very left of center. Of course, by the way, as a footnote, none of the things that he was talking about as party platforms in 1984 ended up in his official party platform for 1984 or 1988, the only thing that ended up there was a resolution to declare South Africa a pariah state. But all of the other things that he talked about jobs and creating universal health care and free college and so forth. None of those things ended up officially as part of his platform because, of course, to appease the Democratic Party, he dropped those. But had Jesse Jackson built his Rainbow Coalition as a viable entity, especially in those states where he won significant numbers of votes and where automatically that should have meant a resulting place on the ballot permanently for the Rainbow Coalition Party. Had he done that, we would have seen an entirely different outcome. Had he even begun in recent months of anticipating this race to situate himself as if he wants to be kingmaker, but there's a responsibility. You can't be kingmaker and still be in bed with the Democrats. You can't serve God and mammon at the same time. I'm using that phrase because, you know, he's a reverend. You have to take sides. And you have to take sides early because supposedly your position as leader gives you extra vision, long-term vision. You can see where things are headed, and that is why you're called upon to function that way. Now, we always are encouraged to believe that things happen in a vacuum. And that this race is just about, well, this race. But I'm here to tell you that we are and have been witnessing the consequence of political action not taken since 1984 and again since 1988, right there in Chicago. And that's the lesson of history. The people who should benefit the most are suffering the most as well. They have the least support from the people who assign themselves as leaders. Their leaders are compromised. Their leaders have no intention of working and building institutions that would outlast them and their damaged egos. So we constantly have to reinvent things. We constantly have to put out 400 different fires all at the same time. We constantly have to develop the talent to dance on both sides of the fence and to try and keep everything working all at the same time. When all you needed to do was to just proceed. People who came before you have contributed to clearing a path for you as it was done for them. This is the lesson of our history here in the United States, especially as an oppressed people. We have the gift given us by people who paid enormous sacrifices and penalties to clear the path. And then we have these gifts entrusted to people not worthy of it. And hence today, Chicago wakes up to the reality that it must all start all over again from square one. And that is assuming that there's an interest in doing so. I want to thank you so much for allowing me to offer these thoughts to you. I'm sure we'll pick that up on Friday with Free Your Mind when we return to our discussions on Free Your Mind Friday. Tomorrow, a very special tribute to a giant among us, Dr. Yosef Ben-Yohanan. And I want to thank you. I want to thank also our listener correspondent, and I'm hoping that many more we can call on our listeners who have something to contribute, very valuable, to the discussion and to our knowledge base here on the program. So I'm so excited that Gardas Henry Watts has been serving in that capacity on the program. This is a great reason that we have Lead Stories, to encourage that kind of participation. Thank you so much. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Keep it right here. NDC Savings Club comes up next. You can reach me. Let me know how this program is resonating with you at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. See you tomorrow.
Chicago.